With just over 4 months until Election Day, the campaigns are in full swing. Maybe you already know how you'll vote. Maybe you're undecided. But how confident are you in our election process? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Politics Wednesday, my guests are computer scientist Doug Jones, co-author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Also, political scientist Tim Hagel. And toward the end of the hour, we'll hear from Bill Schickel, co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa. He'll update us about the lessons learned from this year's caucus counting kerfuffle. Our conversation starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. And today we have one of our usual experts in the booth, so to speak, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Thank you for coming in today, Tim.
You're welcome.
Also joining us, Doug Jones, an Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Iowa. And we've had him in here for a special reason, because we want to focus this hour mainly on the way in which we vote, the election process. And a lot of that has to do with the technology that we use to vote. We want to reach out to you during this hour and ask you how much confidence you have in the technology used in our election process. Perhaps you would like to share your experience in using one of the latest voting machines. They have been changed many times in recent elections. How do you feel about the changes in voting technology? 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver at iowapublicradio.org is our email. And Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook for your feedback. And you can give us a tweet if you'd like. IPR Talk is our tweet. Doug Jones, you are co-author with Barbara Simons of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? In 1994, you were appointed to the Iowa Board of Examiners for Voting Machines and Electronic Voting Systems. You were chairman of that board in 2000 when you began speaking out about the shortcomings of voting technology. In the aftermath of that well-known 2000 election, you were called to testify before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the House Science Committee. You resigned from that board in 2004. And in 2005, you and a group of other researchers were awarded a National Science Foundation grant to establish something called ACURATE. This acronym stands for a Center for Correct, Usable, Reliable, and Transparent Elections. Let's talk about welcome to our program.
Well, welcome.
And let's talk a little bit about what you've discovered in the nearly two decades that you've been examining this. You write in the introduction to your book that one of our most cherished myths is that American democracy sets the gold standard. Why is it a myth?
Well, it's a founding myth of our country, and it's a myth because it hasn't always been true. And yet when we demand that it be true, we come very close. And it's the demand by the public that we live up to the myth that I think makes our democracy as good as it is when it is at its best.
Mm-hmm. You start off your book in the introduction with a quote by Joseph Harris. He is with the Brookings Institution. This was a quote from 1934 when he was there. He writes, "There is probably no other phase of public administration in the United States which is so badly managed as the conduct of elections. Every investigation or election contest brings to light glaring irregularities, errors, misconduct on the part of election officials, officers, disregard of election laws and instructions, slipshod practices, and downright frauds." I hope that we have improved since then, if that evaluation is accurate.
I believe we have. Back in the 1920s, when he was beginning work on that book, there was an election in Chicago where people were throwing hand grenades. It was called the Pineapple Primary. I think we haven't
literally
had any
throwing hand grenades.
Yes, that's why they called it the Pineapple Primary.
Wow.
I think we've gotten better. In fact, I'm fairly certain we've gotten better. The question is, can we stay better?
Okay, let's go back to a point in time that most all of us remember, the 2000 election, hanging chads, the Supreme Court's intervention there to decide ultimately who won that election. Why was that 2000 presidential election a wake-up call?
Mostly because it was close. When elections are close, people find all the irregularities. And I don't think that the irregularities in that election were surprising, really, when you dig down into them. You find that those kinds of things happen fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. Although there is one detail that people generally don't know, and that is that many Florida counties changed their voting equipment right before that election because they were worried about the Y2K bug, and their old voting equipment wasn't Y2K compliant. The software couldn't handle dates after the year 2000. So a lot of counties rushed in the year before that election to replace equipment, and the result is that there was an unusual number of mistakes simply because people were using equipment they'd never used before, administering elections using machinery they'd never used before.
Mm-hmm. So who determines the machinery? Is that state by state or district by district across the United States?
Federalism steps in here and says every state can do it differently if they want. Most states have a fairly similar pattern. It's a pattern that dates back to the 1890s and was really initiated by New York. And that pattern is that the state has a board of some kind that approves which machines are legal for use in that state. And then it's up to the counties to make purchases from the approved list of machines.
Mm-hmm. Give us an overview of the election technology that was used in 2000. And then I want to ask you how that changed because of that election. So what was the state of election of voting in 2000 across the country?
Essentially, every technology in use today was also in use then, although the proportions have changed. The dominant technology then was the punch card, and that's because it was really cost-effective. Punch card voting machines cost a couple $100 at most, and you had to buy new punch cards for each election, but that's cheap pieces of paper compared to big paper ballots. In fact, they're quite cheap. Mechanical lever voting machines, the old 600-pound monsters that lasted forever, they were built like tanks, were still widely used. But the up-and-coming technologies at the time were the optically scanned paper ballot and also the electronic voting machine, where you directly enter your vote on an electronic machine that counts it.
Okay. How did we ever get to punch cards? So it was cost effective. Is it a good way to vote?
Well, when I first encountered punch card ballots in 1968, I was still a student in high school, but I encountered news stories about this new voting technology. This was the computer era coming to voting. We were going to be modern. This was so much more modern than these old mechanical machines. It was cost effective. They were counted by impartial software. It just looked like the obvious technology for the future. And I think not only myself as a high school student back then, but the vast majority of election administrators in the United States had similar thoughts. And the result is that between 1966, when punch cards first saw use in the voting booth, to the to 2000, they grew like wildfire. People thought this was just the modern way to vote.
And what problems do they actually have inherent in those systems?
Well, I went back and read the original punch card voting patents, and the patents for the technology that they were based on. It was the IBM Port-a-Punch. And it turns out every single patent in the first 10 years of that period talks about the problem of hanging chad. Every time they say that if the thing isn't properly adjusted or if you don't maintain it properly, you're going to have this hanging chad problem. And we're going to design a slightly better punch with a little needle tip on it or with little serrated edges or something to not have hanging chad. So all the inventors knew about the chad problem. In addition, there's the problem of proofreading. If you're marking a paper ballot, you see the ink come out of your pen filling the oval, or you see the lead from your pencil filling the oval. You can tell that it's working. With a punch card voting machine, the card is hidden inside the machine under a piece of plastic with holes in it. You cannot actually see the card while you're punching it. And the result is there's a gap, a proofreading gap. You pull the card out of the machine and it's anonymous. They're just a bunch of numbered holes.
And you cannot verify what you did.
In principle, you can. If you read the numbers off and you understand which holes get which numbers and you compare the numbers mm-hmm. with the numbers on the printed face of the machine, in principle, you can. But it's just difficult enough that most voters didn't.
Mm-hmm. So in the aftermath of the 2000 election, passed in 2002, we had the Help America Vote Act. What was that designed to do? What deficiencies was that designed to answer?
Well, I think the answer is political. It was designed to satisfy the public that the government was doing something about a perceived problem. And it did it first by throwing a lot of money at the problem, saying, everybody, here's several $1 billion to replace lots of voting machines that we consider antiquated. And also, we're going to establish new standards for voting machines. As it turned out, most of the money was spent before the new standards were established, so there was something very much cart before the horse about the way the law was written.
Mm-hmm.
And I consider that the major fault of the law is that they spent the money and then decided how to spend it.
Doug Jones of the University of Iowa, professor of computer science, author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Also with us, Tim Hagel. When you think back to the election of 2000 and the hanging chads, what do you see as the political aftermath of that?
Wow. Well, aside from legislation that was passed to try to improve the system, people seem to be more attuned to the problems that existed. And as Doug indicated, and we were talking before the show started, is a lot of times you don't really realize that these problems exist until you actually have a close race, and then you focus like a laser beam on the particular problems. But some of these problems, just, you know, any new technology or any particular form is always going to have some problem, and you may not know what those problems are until you actually do have one of those close elections.
So what is it, what are the most important criteria that we need to evaluate a voting technology? We need to it has to be sort of transparent to the voter. We have to have the ability to recount, don't we? And this is perhaps a problem with the modern technology, Doug Jones?
Well, transparency in an election is crucial because ultimately the purpose of an election is to convince the losers that they lost fair and square. If you don't convince the losers that they lost fair and square, you're going to have riots in the street in some circumstances. And to do that, you need the transparency that everyone can see that their votes were counted correctly, and no additional votes were counted. The ballot boxes shouldn't have been stuffed.
And recounted if necessary.
Well, this is a recount is a form of auditing. You wouldn't let a bank count your money without having auditors step in once in a while and make sure that the banks are doing it right. And a recount is basically it's an audit to ask, were all the votes accounted for correctly? And yes, we need that recountability. We need elections that can be auditable. And we have a century of experience running elections on machines that resist auditing. The mechanical lever voting machines turn out to have many of the same defects as the direct recording electronic voting machines, the so-called touchscreen machines. Okay. So we have, unfortunately, the mechanical precedent.
River to River listeners, how much confidence do you have in our election process? What is your reaction to what you're hearing? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. Stan joins us from Urbandale. What piques your interest in this conversation, Stan?
Well, my question, I guess, would be, or for Mr. Jones maybe, is when are we going to get to online or some sort of phone app type voting? And you know, I know there are issues, I guess, with hacking more than accuracy, but if you could comment on that, I'd really like to hear about that.
The Internet, of course, ubiquitous. Isn't that a technology we can use to vote?
It would be nice. And there are a lot of reasons to be very wary of it. People frequently point to the parallel with electronic commerce. I can buy a hotel room over the Internet. I can bank over the Internet. I can buy books over the Internet. But in those cases, the consequences of fraud are fairly easily limited. I don't get the book I ordered. my credit card gets billed more than it should have, and I can catch that when my credit card statement comes. This gets much harder with elections where you can't catch it. It turns out that with electronic banking, the banks don't reveal how much money they lose to fraud. It's bad for stockholders. It's bad for public confidence in the banks, so they just don't tell us. It turns out that the cost of fraud is significant, but it's cheaper than hiring tellers to let everyone bank over the counter. So tolerating fraud is something they simply pay for. I'm not sure we want to run elections that way. And right now, every week there seems to be a new story about some government database that got hacked, some government computer systems that got compromised. And one thing I know for certain is that the resources of the county election administrators that are running our elections from day to day to handle these high-pressure computer security jobs are much lower than the resources of the large corporations and the government agencies that are routinely being hacked these days.
Tim Hagel, can you give us an idea of how the parties in the U.S., the political parties, break down in their view of these issues, the different ways of voting, and perhaps also comment on the possibility of internet voting, which Stan mentioned?
Well, to pick up on the internet side of things, yeah, I think there are going to be problems there. One of the things I was thinking about as he was talking about this was that it may raise that federalism question again just because of the resource issue, that the counties and the localities don't have the resources. The federal government might, but would you be willing, and you in sort of the general sense of the public, be willing to then turn those activities over to the federal government? And I think that with, at least on the Republican side of things, a concern of federalism and states' rights, I don't think that they would want to do that necessarily. In terms of the parties generally looking at some of these issues, I was thinking earlier that, you know, it really depends on where the voting is taking place, whether you're concerned about fraud or technical issues or what have you. And one of the interesting things about the 2000 election is that during the course of it, both sides were unhappy with what was going on. Initially, it was the Republicans because they thought that the standards were being changed in terms of how to count the various hanging chads and so forth. And then when it turned out that George W. Bush took the lead, that the Democrats were unhappy. And then, of course, it went to the Supreme Court that made the final decision. But still, both sides were unhappy. And so it sort of brought that particular issue to the fore.
Curtis is with us from Cedar Rapids. Thanks for calling 1-866-780-9100. Curtis, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I have been listening here. I was the one that posed a question about the internet in the first place. You know, in reality, most of these people that are references or talking about internet and voting, they always come up with fraud, just like this guy did. The truth of the matter is that, you know, you can trade millions of dollars over an E-Trade or Ameritrade account. You know, your vote is one in 315 million people. Okay, it's only a matter of time before we actually decide that the internet is how we're going to vote. I mean, there are newspapers across America going bankrupt because they can't compete with the internet. And you're telling me we can't have people log in with their social, with the four-digit PIN code, and vote?
Okay, Curtis, thank you for that point. A challenge from Curtis in Cedar Rapids. Your reaction, Professor Jones?
Well, four-digit PIN codes only work because you also have a card, and the physical possession of that card plus the four-digit PIN code makes things reasonably secure. If you don't have a card, if you're just going onto a website, you need to have a much bigger code. The biggest problem with internet voting, though, is this federalism issue. If you centralize the election system, running it through a centralized national server, then you become extraordinarily vulnerable to centralized fraud. If I were a Republican today, I would be very upset with the possibility that the executive branch might control the election machinery. If I were a Democrat, I would be very upset if there was a Republican administration in control of the election machinery. Federalism, where we spread things out, 50 states plus four territories, where we spread things out over 3,000 counties running elections separately, by doing that, it makes it much, much harder to attack the whole system. But the local end ends up being vulnerable. So if you look at election fraud in the United States today, there's not that much of it. But when it occurs, it tends to be local. It's a local county election administration that's ending up rigging elections in that county for local office. This most recently happened in Clay County, Kentucky in 2010, where there were some major convictions.
Let's go to Klaus in Ames. Klaus dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Klaus.
Hi. I'm always concerned when there are big discrepancies between exit polls, where people are asked directly how they voted, and then the official vote count, which is often done on private voting machines with proprietary software. Recently in Wisconsin, during the recall election, they said it was 50-50 by exit poll and then a 7% difference to the official result. And also remember Hillary Clinton's win in New Hampshire during primaries against Obama at the time was very unexpected. Mm-hmm. And in Germany, the exit polls are very close to the actual results. So really makes me concerned that something is going on that's not quite right.
Okay. Thank you, Klaus. Tim Hagel, should Klaus be concerned about the effect of exit polls?
Well, I think that the concern here is the quality of the exit polls rather than perhaps something nefarious going on in terms of the vote count. Particularly in, as he indicated, in what happened in Wisconsin. And I know I was watching the returns and was expecting a very late night. All the exit polls said it was 50-50, and it turned out to not be that, although it did narrow as the night went on and got to about 7%, which is what he had, Governor Walker had won in his original election. But I think the problem there, and many media critics were talking about this, is that the exit polls were just done for some reason, not well, that there were problems with it, either in terms of the sample. And that's the thing that you have to run into if you're taking exit polls, is that you have to, A, have somebody that's willing to talk to you after having voted. Not everybody is. And then, B, you have to make sure that you are, in fact, getting a decent sample. And sometimes the entities that are taking these polls just make a mistake. And that's the nature of polling.
Mm-hmm. Exit polling, a comment on that, Professor Jones, Doug?
I basically stand by what he said. The basic problem is exit polls are not designed as an auditing tool. They're designed as a way of trying to, well, from the media perspective, trying to keep the audience engaged for the entire duration of the counting process.
Okay, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the election process. Do you have confidence in how we run our elections, in the latest voting machines, in all the changes that you've seen in voting technology? We want to hear from you, 1-866-780-9100. And voter fraud is the topic here as well. Tim Hagel, quickly list off some other aspects of voter fraud that we might want to talk about when we come back.
Voter registration, whether you need to show an ID, what happens with absentee ballots. There's a whole list of things.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Doug Jones, Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Iowa, co-author of Broken Ballots, the new book, Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Tell us what you think. Also later in the hour, Bill Schickel, co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa. He's also the chair of the Caucus Review Committee. We'll hear his update on, what did we call it, a caucus counting kerfuffle. We'll find out if he agrees with that descriptor when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In our studio today, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Also, Doug Jones, Associate Professor of Computer Science at the University of Iowa, computer scientist on our show today. We have him on the program because he has spent the better part of two decades looking at the way in which we vote, the technology we use to vote, and the confidence that inspires or does not inspire in our elections. Broken Ballots is the title of a new book that he's co-authored, Will Your Vote Count? And we've been talking about a number of aspects of getting it right so that you have confidence that your vote does count. What is your experience in using the latest voting machines. What are your questions about the changes in voting technology that we've experienced right here in Iowa? One of our listeners joining us now, calling up, Sue Dvorsky, chair of the Democrats in Iowa, joining us from Coralville. Sue Dvorsky, thank you for calling. A little later in the program, we'll have a counterpart of yours, Bill Schickel, a co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa. What does what do you want to say about the discussion we're having today, Sue?
Hi, Ben. Hi, Professor Jones, Professor Hagel. Well, I came in listening a little bit late. I always like to listen to Politics Wednesday. But, you know, so I hope this point already hasn't been made, but one of the things, every 4 years is the only opportunity really every American has to cast a vote in that single big federal race. And so every 4 years it seems like, and Doug certainly would have, you know, more of a view on this maybe than I do, but it seems to me like every 4 years we focus on this. But in truth, the bulk of the times that a citizen takes a public vote, there have been scores of local and state elections since the last time we voted for president. And that's one of the things I think that really argues strongly against the notion of federalism, because the really and truly most of the voting that a citizen participates in, he or she participates in that at a very local level. And that's why I think it's so critical to keep resources and attention focused on making sure that we're doing the very best job we can at the closest level to the voter, because, in fact, this only happens once every 4 years where we get the opportunity, you know, all 300 million of us or whatever to participate in this one ballot. But really and truly, that's very rare.
Mm. Sue Dvorsky, thank you for making that point. Chair of Iowa's Democrats calling from Coralville. You do make that point, Doug Jones, in your book, that the U.S. elections are special. It's not cut and dried. What is your reaction? And tell us, through your eyes, how U.S. elections are special.
Well, first, I agree completely with Sue Dvorsky. If you're an election administrator, you're running 4 elections a year on average. There's a special election almost always every year. Someone will pull a special election. There's a school board election. There is a municipal election. With all of the elections, we end up on average about 4 elections a year. And only one of those every 2 years is a general election where the congressman is up, and every 4 years the president. That really matters. U.S. elections are special because we put so many issues on the ballot. Our ballots have 20 to 40 different offices on the ballot, 40 when you get large counties with big judicial retention races. And no one else in the world would imagine putting that many races on one ballot. The Swiss think they're extreme. They sometimes have as many as 8 different races on one ballot. The Swiss are also viewed within Europe as being eccentric by being compulsively democratic and voting on everything. But we vote on more.
Mm. Tim Hagel, I know you have to you have a pressing appointment and have to leave in a couple of minutes. I wonder if we could get your thoughts before you do leave our studio about registration, voting registration requirements, and how that fits into our discussion today.
Well, it gets at a little bit different aspect to voting problems. I'll say that more generically, and that's when sort of the beginning of the process. And of course, we have concern about citizenship, and you hear problems, particularly in Florida right now, where they're going through fights over who's eligible to vote, citizenship, that sort of thing. And even here in a place like the University of Iowa, where you have people that are residents of other states paying out-of-state tuition fees, and yet they can register here, and as they should, because as I argue to my students and get them to register here, is that you live here 9 months of the year, so you should. This is where you should be voting, although many of them still like to vote in their home places or home states. So we have to be concerned about that. Also, the question of felons. Usually, if you're convicted of a felony, you lose your voting rights, among others, and you can apply to get those back, but there's a process that's involved there. And the question is, well, how complicated should that process be? Should it be automatic once you're released from jail or prison and so forth? So some of those issues come into the registration portion of the problem.
Is this a correct question to ask Tim Hagel? Should we err on the side of preventing fraud or err on the side of greater participation in elections?
That's a good question, and I think to some extent the answer, at least at this point, will depend on which party you're in. That by and large, you have to strike a balance between the two. You do want accuracy. You do want people to feel comfortable that people are voting that are authorized to vote. But on the other hand, you don't want to exclude too many people unnecessarily for whatever reason the reason happens to be. And so you need to strike some sort of balance or compromise between the two positions.
Tell us how photo IDs bring to the polling places. Of course, that's been in our news. That's also a partisan issue.
It is, although, again, the particular party that's concerned about it varies over time. And right now it's the Republicans that are emphasizing the need for a photo ID. And you can see that in places where, again, just to use the Iowa City area where you have a major university where you have students that register and then maybe move to a different location or graduate and move to a different city and so forth, but their names remain on the ballot at least until it's cross-checked with the various state auditors and is removed. And until that happens, it's possible if somebody knew that somebody was registered and just came in and say, hey, I'm this person and has a utility bill or something, without a photo ID, you would never know. So there's no way to check that. And so there's always a concern that that could throw an election if it's a close one.
Tim Hagel, I know you have to duck out of the studio. Thank you for being with us. Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Always a pleasure, Tim.
You're welcome.
Let's go back to our callers. We still have, of course, Doug Jones, a computer science professor at the University of Iowa. Broken Ballots, the title of his new book, Will Your Vote Count? Joe is joining us from Ames. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been a poll worker for over 15 years, maybe 20 years now. And we had our go-around here in Story County and other counties, too, with this touchscreen voting machine. We had a couple of them break. We weren't sure that they were counting right. And since then, we have disposed of those and just used the optical scanner. My question is, does Mr. Jones know how many counties in Iowa are still using the touchscreen machine, and how many states in our nation are still using touchscreen voting machines without a paper backup?
Thank you, Joe.
Well, first, thank you for being a poll worker. America's elections require a huge number of people. It takes about 1% of the electorate to run an election. And it's guaranteed it's going to be volunteers, it's going to be temporary employees, and we rely for our democracy on the integrity of those people. It's really important. So thank you for that. In answer to your question, Iowa got rid of all of its touchscreen voting machines. This happened under Chet Culver's administration. And it was a hard-argued question because some of them were fairly new and the money had just been spent. And deciding that you had made a mistake is always very hard. Once a public official spends a large amount of money on new equipment, to admit that that wasn't the best of all possible equipment is a painful decision, painful admission.
That was a large amount of money. Do you
it
have a dollar?
Certainly
a
was.
Dollar figure
I
in
don't
that?
Have the dollar figure. Mm-hmm. Nationwide, the trend has been away from touchscreen electronic voting machines, but that trend is far from uniform. There are a number of states which use them statewide, notably Maryland and Georgia. There are a number of states which have a fairly high presence of them, and they'll last for a while. But most of the machines are aging. There isn't much new development going on in that area.
Let's go to John in Des Moines. John, listening. Good afternoon to you, John.
Hey.
What's your question, John?
Well, my question is, if you're concerned about hacking and computer vote counting, why can't, and the previous caller mentioned something about a paper backup, why don't we get a receipt that we can look at and see that it's checked the right boxes, and then we drop it in a box that's counted somewhere else?
We use it to verify our checkouts at the supermarket. Why not voting?
There have been people who've designed machines like that. The idea of having the touchscreen machine print out a paper ballot that you could then inspect and carry to a ballot box and drop it in for counting has been explored. It hasn't proven to be very popular with election officials. It's more equipment. And face it, the more different pieces of machinery you have to buy, the more difficult it is to administer an election. But every county in Iowa has some kind of machine to allow blind voters to vote, and these typically are machines that operate more or less the way you described.
Doug Jones is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Iowa. Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count, a book that he's just co-authored. And so many questions that revolve, that are found in this book, examined. We wouldn't have the whole hour to examine all of them. We want to save some time right now to go to Bill Schickel. He is the co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa, also the chairman of the Caucus Review Committee. Iowa Republicans have been continuing their review of the 2012 precinct caucuses, what went right with those, what didn't, back in January. In addition to hearing from party members, the party-appointed Iowa Review Caucus Review Committee is offering recommendations on how to improve the caucuses. And if you remember, the caucus night results showed Mitt Romney winning by 8 votes. 2 weeks later, after the results were certified, Rick Santorum was the winner by 34 votes. Good afternoon. Welcome to our program, Bill Schickel, chairman of the Caucus Review Committee, co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa.
Good afternoon, Ben. It's great to be with you this afternoon, and good afternoon to Professor Jones as well.
You have said that the party has to look at the mistakes that were made, acknowledge them, review them, and fix them. Where does your work stand on the committee?
Well, let me just first of all say, Ben, that after listening to the program for the last few minutes, I already felt good about the Iowa caucuses, but I'm feeling even better right now, recognizing, and I think this puts things in perspective, that mistakes have happened in other areas as well. You know, I think the lessons that we've learned are, though, that the smallest of errors are significant in any election. How you release the information is as important as the information itself. And then finally, that training is critical, and we plan to address all three of those areas within our recommendations, Ben.
Mm-hmm. When will those recommendations be out?
They will be out on Monday. The third public meeting of the Iowa Caucus Review Commission will take place in Sioux City at 1 p.m. at Western Iowa Tech Community College, and we plan to present those recommendations, and the full committee is scheduled to vote on those on Monday. You may recall that a month ago we released preliminary recommendations in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Can you summarize those?
Yes, and they focus on three areas. One is the release of information. The other is ballot integrity, and the final one is training. Concerning the release of information, we surveyed more than 600 Republicans, and the biggest criticism came forward in how we released the information, and I happen to agree with that. And so they're fairly straightforward public relations things, such as all parties will have access to information at the same time. If the spread between the two top vote getters is less than 1%. No winner will be officially declared on caucus night until the ballots are certified. And then the other thing regarding certification, we collapsed the time frame down to 72 hours. Previously, it was 2 weeks. We'll be requiring that certification be done within 72 hours so that the results can be put forward prior to the New Hampshire primary. In the area of ballot integrity, the standard paper ballot should be used. And listening to the conversation, I found this fascinating because, you know, we ran a fairly low-tech operation last time, yet we had a record turnout, closest election in history, and 99% of our precincts reporting caucus night. But to have those standardized ballots distributed at registration time, that the ballots be placed by individual caucusers in a ballot box, and that they be counted in the main caucus room are some of the preliminary recommendations. Then in the area of training, the training material be provided earlier, that more training be conducted, that paper reporting forms are in triplicate, and that any electronic reporting forms have redundancy. Those are some of the preliminary recommendations. We will have some others as well on Monday.
Bill Schickel's co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa. Professor Jones, react to those recommendations.
They seem pretty sensible. I'm particularly in agreement with the fact that reporting is a significant part of the problem. that the pressure from the media to declare a winner can be poisonous, and that holding off when you think that there is any doubt, when there's not enough precincts reporting, that makes excellent sense. The errors that occurred in this time around in the Republican caucus were errors that I've seen happen in real elections, where someone goes home at a late night time from a polling place or from a caucus site and doesn't turn in their forms, leaves them in the trunk of the car and forgets about them the next morning. Those kinds of things happen in real elections. It's a fairly normal kind of error. In fact, some of them happened in Florida in 2000. They hardly got noticed by the media because there were other issues that looked bigger. But when those happen in a very close election, it always creates trouble. There's an old joke in the election administration business that the election administrator's prayer goes, "Dear God, I don't care who wins as long as the margin is wide."
Back to
Professor Jones, while I have you here, I'm just wondering if I could ask you, take advantage of this opportunity, would you have any particular recommendations to correct problems within the tabulation of the Iowa caucuses?
I think you're doing reasonably sensibly. I mean, I'm an outsider. I'm a Democrat. But I don't see any major problems with the way the Republican caucuses are being run.
How much time, Professor Jones, do you think should pass? This is something that Bill Schickel addressed, between the end of the election and certifying results. Should that be set?
You have to set a deadline. On the other hand, it has to be generous enough to allow people to find the problems before the deadline. A two-day deadline strikes me as a bit harsh. A two-week deadline seems a little bit generous. The problem is, if the deadline is too soon, you're going to get people who are you're going to have difficulty tracking down those papers in the trunk of the car that somebody locked in and forgot.
Bill Schickel, we only have a couple minutes left. I sensed you wanted to jump in again.
Well, I was just going to thank Professor Jones for his comments. He mentioned that he's a Democrat, and we're staying in close communication with the Democratic Party on this, because the Iowa caucuses are not just important to Republicans. They're important to Democrats, all Iowans, and indeed the nation as well.
Do you think, Bill Schickel, what damage do you think, and this is not a partisan question, what do you think that the damage suffered by the Iowa caucuses was in this case?
Well, I think there was some damage to the reputation of the Iowa caucuses. Iowa Republicans don't believe that. By 79% majority, according to our survey, they believe strongly in the integrity of the process. But I think the good news is that any of the problems and the mistakes that were made are very fixable, and that's what we intend to do.
So you think any damage done to the name, the institution of the Iowa caucuses, is not long-lasting?
No, I think that the Iowa caucuses are a shining example of the very best that democracy has to offer, and I think with the fixes that we will offer, they will continue to remain in that role. And hearing this conversation today makes me even more optimistic.
Okay, thank you very much. Bill Schickel, co-chair of the Republican Party of Iowa, chairman of the Caucus Review Committee, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Doug Jones, perhaps the last word from you today, either about the Iowa caucuses or perhaps to summarize the most crucial reforms you feel need to happen to improve our election process.
Well, first I want to motivate people. Get out and vote. Get involved in the process. Take stands on issues. But the other thing is, when an election occurs and there are any questions raised about the problem, about the election, it's always the losers who raise those hard questions. So when you hear hard questions being raised about an election, don't just jump on people for asking questions. I one of the things that offended me the most after the Bush-Gore election was the sore loser man joke about Gore Lieberman. The fact is, the losers are always the ones who are asking the hard questions. And yes, it may seem sore, but if we don't have a strong opposition party, democracy gets really bad. So whichever party is currently in the leadership, we need opposition. And those people in the opposition have an extraordinarily important role asking hard questions.
And so you're saying, even if your party is on the winning side, you should try to be nonpartisan in the way you evaluate if there are questions about how the ballot was conducted.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in today. Doug Jones is an associate professor of computer science at the University of Iowa, co-author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? You are with the Accurate Center for Correct, Usable, Reliable, and Transparent Elections. What's the future there quickly?
Well, the Accurate grant expired.
It is.
So, and at this point, there is no replacement.
Okay. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise, your research in this area, Doug Jones. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting available, also on-demand audio. If you caught part of this program, you want to hear the entire hour, you can do that with any of our programs. Go to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow on this program, for half of the program, we'll be talking with University of Iowa President Sally Mason, and we hope you'll join us. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us today.